The EU-Israel Association Council has taken place to discuss issues such as the conflict in Ukraine, the energy crisis, and cooperation in the areas of trade and climate change.
Is there any common ground between Israel and the EU on the issue of the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, this is one of the issues in which certainly we disagree. And Prime Minister Lapid has been very vocal in expressing his disagreement with this process. But I have a mandate from the United Nations, and that's what I'm trying to do. By the time being, in any case, the negotiations are stalled.
Palestinian rights campaigners gathered outside the European Council building in Brussels where the EU-Israel meeting was taking place. They asked, why is this suddenly happening after a 10-year break?
It's a good question. Why do we want to resume it now? Because we need the gas, or what is the reason? Even though, actually, the apartheid policy that Israel is implementing is increasing and is worsening every day. They are colonizing more, building more settlements.
Israeli army killed Palestinian guys and children every day. They steal homes in Jerusalem and West Bank. They expand their illegal settlements.
We see the EU as a colonial institution supporting and funding the existence of the settlements and the Israeli Zionist colony inside Palestine and over the rights of the Palestinian people.
It's perhaps noteworthy that there was no press conference following the EU-Israel Association Council. Therefore, journalists were unable to ask questions. Prior to this meeting, Human Rights Watch released a statement which says, instead of reciting empty platitudes, European officials should use the Association Council to finally condemn Israel's apartheid and persecution and make clear there will be meaningful consequences should the Israeli government not reverse course. Of course, this statement was ignored. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Energy, housing, and soaring prices across the board. Britain's cost of living crisis is worsening and people are suffering. Giovanni and his wife are two of over 1,000 protesters greeting the Conservative Party conference here in Birmingham.
They don't care about ordinary people. They just want to hold on to power and maximise their own purses and get as much money out for themselves as they possibly can. It's despicable.
Conservative Prime Minister Liz Truss's government has nailed its colours to the mast. Tax cuts favouring the rich, business enterprise zones, and billions to slow the rise of household energy bills, which have gone up again this week. But all of it uncosted, sending the markets into a meltdown. How will British taxpayers afford it?
People are absolutely terrified about what's going to happen to their mortgages. They're terrified about their energy bills. They're terrified about, generally, the cost of living. And yet, at the same time, for those on over £150,000 a year, they're going to get much better off as a result of this.
The PM has pledged her government will keep an iron grip on national finances as part of her commitment to sound money. The subtext, looming cuts to already struggling public services.
They always say that we've got to pay the price for their problems. They created these problems. They create the wars, they create the shortages, and then workers are meant to pay for that and divide ourselves amongst each other. We're not going to have that.
But Liz Truss and Finance Minister Kwasi Kwarteng say they're determined to hold their nerve, promising a medium-term fiscal plan and independent analysis. Not now, but in November. As Birmingham hosts the conference, the Welsh and Scottish administrations have demanded a crisis summit, while the Labour Party, now with a 33-point lead in the polls, says a government appointed solely by party members has no mandate.
The UK is in a financial crisis. Protests such as this one are drawing more and more people onto the streets nationwide, meaning the pressure on this government to deliver beyond the conference walls is reaching boiling point.
Liz Truss has never had a problem charming the party faithful, but it won't be just her allies watching. Grassroots pressure is rising. Change is on the horizon. Saeed Pourreza, Birmingham.
Afghanistan is still reeling from Friday's bomb attack in a Shia neighborhood in Kabul that left dozens of people dead and scores of others wounded. One of the victims of the attack was 18-year-old Najiba, whose family is grieving her loss. Najiba's father says he had raised his daughter with great difficulties, but lost her in the blink of an eye.
I've had a great passion in educating my children. I'm illiterate but love to see my children educated. However, I'm an ordinary worker, but I always supported them throughout their school with everything they needed. My daughter, Najiba, was so smart and intelligent. I was proud of her and loved her so much. I feel heartbroken that I'm not seeing her future and I've lost her forever.
Sakina Surosh, Najiba's sister and a social activist, says that systematic attacks on Shia mosques and schools must end. She calls on the UN to recognize such attacks as massacre.
My demand from the international bodies, especially the UN, is that the latest attack on Qaj Educational Center and other onslaughts on Shia community must be recognized as massacre and Hazara genocide. These attacks are systematically targeting innocent people from a specific ethnic group. The UN should not neglect in this regard and must take practical steps to protect persecuted Hazaras.
Beside international bodies and human rights groups, Afghanistan Shia Clerics Council has called for an investigation into such attacks. The council called on the global community to end their silence on the murders of Shia Hazaras in Afghanistan.
Afghan clerics strongly condemn the attack on education and innocent students. We seriously call on the Taliban to take urgent and practical actions for ensuring security for all, especially Hazara people. The organizers and financiers of such crimes should be brought to justice. The international community must end their silence on the plight of Hazara people in Afghanistan.
Rights groups say the Daesh terrorist group has been responsible for 13 attacks against Hazaras since the Taliban's return to power. The attacks have killed or wounded at least 700 people from the community. The latest bomb attack has shocked people here. They are calling on the international community not to turn a blind eye on the plight of Shia Hazaras in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Palestinians held a mass rally in the blockaded Gaza Strip to support Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds in the face of growing Israeli aggressions against the Holy City. People shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and slammed the silence of Arab countries on Israel's crimes in Al-Quds. Tensions have been on the rise in recent weeks as extremist Israeli settlers and Israeli forces desecrated the city's Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which organized the rally, warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds.
We're sending a clear message to the whole world that the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian people are in a constant battle against the Israeli enemy and will not remain silent over aggressions against Al-Aqsa.
People from all walks of life gathered to express their support for resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli attacks.
People in Gaza are attending this rally to affirm our support and full backing for the Palestinian resistance. We believe that armed resistance is key to the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against them. Al-Quds is sacred to all Muslims, and Palestinians consider it as the capital of their future state.
We are here to support Al-Aqsa Mosque because it's part of our faith, and we are willing to sacrifice our lives in order to protect it. Gaza will always defend Al-Quds, and we call on all Arabs and Muslims to protect Al-Quds.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice.
Palestinians say they will use all forms of resistance to protect Al-Aqsa Mosque and the holy city of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
We'll be right back.
First, an announcement by Yemen's Ansar al-Mubin that the truce with the Saudi-led coalition had reached a dead end. Meanwhile, the U.S. thanked Saudi Arabia for extending the truce, not knowing the Yemeni government had refused to go ahead with a truce that did not progress and yield any meaningful results. Now, not surprisingly, there are reports of sporadic fighting in different parts of the country. In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll look at why there was not any progress in these talks. Why it failed? Was it due to the Saudis' economic stranglehold on the port city of Aden, for example? Or were the Saudis and the backers just buying time throughout the time the ceasefire was in effect? And why? First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti joins us from Sana'a. Also joining us, political activist Fra Hughes joins us from Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Fra Hughes, let me first start with you. We're looking at this UN-mediated ceasefire that took effect at this point from April, but now it has ended. The reasons behind it ending is something I'd like to ask you, because the way it was reported, it was as if the Ansar movement said we're not going to continue with it, which in essence they didn't, but the reports didn't indicate why, which was, and your opinion matters, that they did not see any progress. They did not see anything coming back in return. For any of the stated goals that they wanted in their minds. Why do you think this truce failed?
Yes, hello everybody. Well, I think what I've seen written down is that the Ansarallah movement had asked for the total lifting of the siege to allow full humanitarian aid, full fuel ship deposits to come into the country, and an opportunity to alleviate the humanitarian crisis that has befallen the country because of the Saudi Arabian US-financed UAE bombing attacks on the country. So, I mean, it takes two people to come into ceasefire negotiations. It takes two people, two groups, two political ideologies to try and decide how to move that truce forward. But by telling the Ansarallah movement that the Americans and the Saudis and the puppet Yemeni government were happy to have a cessation of the violence, which in itself would allow the Saudis, the UAE, and the Yemeni government to restock, to regroup, and to basically go again if that becomes their motive going forward. So I think the Ansarallah movement are quite correct. I am not an advocate for violence. I don't want to see any more deaths in Yemen. But until there is a total ending of the siege and humanitarian aid and food and fuel and medicines are allowed to flow unhindered into the ports and into the airport, I'm not sure that the Ansarallah movement had any other option but to refuse to extend a ceasefire unless these conditions were met.
Well, the Yemeni government's reason was about this blockade, that was the main obstacle behind why this actually faltered and fell apart, basically, because it did not help a way forward in order to achieve peace between the two sides. Now, the question here is as to why Saudi Arabia or the Saudi-led coalition is, I'm not even too sure what's left of the coalition. Is it just the UAE? Mm-hmm. I think it's just the UAE. If there's any other country, I think they're the only ones left. Anyways, what is their problem there? I mean, if you think about the logistics, well, they could put on as many people in the, to man the ships, to use as security in order to check the goods or what have you, so they don't see anything suspicious flowing through. Because it's either that, or we're looking at what, 21 million people who are in dire need of basic goods and medicine?
Well, if we look at the tactics behind the siege, if you look at the siege on Gaza, that's not about the reported stopping weapons coming in from Iran or Hezbollah or any other member of the Axis of Resistance, because they could do exactly the same. In fact, I remember when the Mavi Marmara ship left Turkey, it had been searched by the Turkish government forces and customs, and it just had wheelchairs and medicines and artificial prosthetics to take to Gaza, yet that boat was boarded in international waters by Israeli commandos. So the siege is not about preventing weapons getting into the hands of your opponents. The siege is this unilateral coercive measure used in order to try and force regime change by physically making 21 million people starve, by telling the people that there is no other way except the Saudi way, and that if people don't adhere to the regime change policies and the reinstallment of the Saudi and American puppet Yemeni government, that all they can expect out of this is to die. And without the Ansarallah movement there to try and defend the people and reunify the country and remove this foreign ideological, financial and military occupation of their country, I think that the Hadi government, or whoever they have in the wings to replace that, would already be back in charge, and there would be no change, and people would still be starving, and the money would still be leaving the country. And in the proxy war with Iran through Yemen by Saudi Arabia and America and the French and the Germans and the British, I think, you know, that this isn't going to end anytime soon. And I think that the Ansarallah movement has stood bravely in the face of huge opposing forces.
Interesting. It's a very dark outlook looking forward from this point on. So let's welcome back Hossein Al-Bukhaiti. Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, welcome. Looking at why this fragile ceasefire or truce failed, the ones that are reporting it, Western media are saying the Ansarallah movement didn't want it to continue. But it's not the case. They weren't getting anything back in return that was tangible enough for them to say, okay, we're reaching some results. Why do you think this was not continued by the Ansarallah movement, the ceasefire or truce?
It has been really clear that since Sana'a negotiation team has went to Kuwait or to Stockholm or and Geneva 1 and Geneva 2, they have been always putting a goal for Yemeni salaries to be paid to all Yemenis across Yemen. But it seems to be that the Saudi actually who is benefiting from the oil and gas revenue, as we know that 85% to 90% of Yemeni budget used to come from oil and gas revenue. But on the top of that, we've seen that the Saudi actually, they are taking those revenues and they are not paying the salaries of Yemenis. Sana'a demand actually is not for the good of Ansarullah, the Houthi movement. It's for the good of all Yemeni civilians as well. The blockade on Yemen, Saudi is continuing to block most of the fuel and food and medicine ship that's entering Hodeidah. They are as well didn't allow more flight to go out of Sana'a airport, especially Sana'a was promised from the United Nations that one of the flight will be going from Sana'a to Cairo, because tens of thousands of Yemenis in urgent need of medical care, and they used to go to Cairo and Egypt before the war. And we see that this blockade on Yemen actually is affecting hundreds, millions of Yemeni civilians. More than 300,000 Yemeni civilians have died because of this blockade. The price of fuel has increased, and we see on the other hand that the Saudi and United States and as well many European countries like UK, France, and Germany, they are actually keen for this truce to continue because of the war in Ukraine. They are afraid that if Sana'a will target Saudi oil infrastructure and United Arab Emirates oil infrastructure, that the price of gas and oil will increase in Europe. That's why they don't want this to happen, because they do care about their population. But here in Sana'a, when they asked that those salaries must be paid, we see that the Saudi refused, and the United Nations actually is not doing anything. They have been promising that they will see a way to pay the salaries, but still they are trying to use the blockade and as well blocking Yemenis from having their salaries as a weapons. And Sana'a, at this time, they will not accept that. They have agreed to extend this truce 3 times, and for the last 6 months, Saudi Arabia still sometime have targeted areas in Yemen with airstrike, like in Hodeida and in Saada. They have delayed some of the flight. They have blocked many ships from entering Hodeida. So this truce actually is only in the benefit of Saudi Arabia and in the benefit of Europe and as well United States, just for the gas and oil from the Gulf state to go easily to those countries who are supporting the war. But I believe now Sana'a have the biggest chance actually to stop this war, because they should look at what's happening to the economy of many countries who are supporting this war, and they should actually make advantage from this war in Ukraine for Yemenis by targeting Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates oil infrastructure.
Well, Farah, we're trying to understand where both sides or each side is coming from. Now, in terms of Saudi Arabia, during the time that this truce was in effect, we're not seeing them create any type of momentum when it comes to any type of compromise, it appears. They have come out with a grand scheme. I think it was about 10 or 15 points of promises of millions, if not billions, of dollars for either infrastructure, transit routes, et cetera. But then, as our guest there just mentioned, when it comes to the oil revenues, no, they're not going to budge on that. They won't let, as the Supreme Political Council of Yemen said, for the Yemeni people to get the oil revenues and the gas resources. Or when it comes to the siege that we talked about, it doesn't budge on that either. So I think that gives the right for the Ansarullah movements or the official government of Yemen not to proceed with these talks.
Yes, absolutely. I totally agree 100% with my comrade from Yemen. If we look even at the briefest history, slightly before the truce was inaugurated, it was the actual drone attacks on the Amroco facilities in Saudi Arabia and the threats of attacks on the oil infrastructure in the United Arab Emirates that appears to have been the kind of linchpin and catalyst that brought the Saudi puppet regime into the talks with the Ansarullah movement government. So, you know, obviously what's happened in my mind is they have offered an olive branch to the Ansarullah movement, but it was only ever there to deceive those people, to be delaying tactics. If they could have the ceasefire extended and extended and extended while offering very little or nothing or sound bites or some political document instead of tangibly raising and lifting the siege, tangibly paying the wages of the civil servants, allowing the oil revenue to be used for the good of the Yemeni people. What we have is, very obviously, as this conversation develops, Saudi Arabia is the imperialist interloper in Yemen, stealing the natural resources that belong to the Yemenese people. So the Ansarullah movement has every right to say the Saudis, the UAE, and the mercenaries who are there in their thousands have no right to be occupying Yemeni soil. The future of Yemen belongs to the Yemen people. It doesn't belong to America, France, Germany, the UK, Saudi Arabia, or the United Arab Emirates. They're not going to leave anytime soon. There's too much money involved. There's too much political intrigue. Yemen is seen to be a member of the Axis of Resistance. Therefore, it's a target for America, and it's a target for the EU. So, you know, we need to have a victory by the Ansarullah movement. Otherwise, we will just have a continued warfare for as long as America and Saudi Arabia is happy to bomb infrastructure and civilians in Yemen.
But this is how this was this point was actually covered, Farahiz, where it said Yemen's internationally recognized government, via a tweet from its Washington embassy, urged the U.S. Security Council to deal firmly with the Ansarullah movement over their latest threats and refusal to actually extend the ceasefire or the truce. First question that comes to mind here to ask you, is Yemen's internationally, quote, internationally recognized governments located in Washington?
It's not located in Washington. I'm not even secure it's located in Yemen. I thought it was in exile in Riyadh when President Hadi kind of debunked there whenever he was under threat from a popular people-led revolution. But what it does maybe explain is that it's not the internationally recognized government of Yemen. It's not even the Saudi government, but it is the government in Washington. It is Joe Biden and his friends that are running the show the same way they are in Ukraine. This is just another geopolitical regional war being waged as part of a larger conflict between the American kind of exceptionalism and hegemony and New World Order and unipolar order. And they're just actually using the people of Yemen as the cannon fodder, as they are in Ukraine against Russia, because it's a proxy war against Iran. And I do genuinely believe that unless, you know, the drone technology that the Ansar Allah movement has proved to possess is used against the oil infrastructure in these other countries, there will be no peace.
Well, listen, if you want to take a look at the U.S. position here, and might I add European countries in the mix also, we're looking at Saudi Arabia, where in the past months, minimum several months, maybe up to a year at this point, selling oil at $100 a barrel, average median. They're flush with cash. The latest news that we got on particular military sales was from Germany, where the German government approved the new arms export to Saudi Arabia. It had said that it would halt it, even the new coalition government, when it came into power in December, said we will not sell arms to Saudi Arabia. But they went ahead and they did it. So looking at other countries and the U.S., do you think that they are going to now start selling arms at a fast pace, given the fact that, you know, we're looking at this the kingdom flush with cash?
Well, I think it's quite possible. A six-month lull has been an opportunity for Saudi Arabia to replenish its stock of arms. I thought Joe Biden said after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi that Saudi Arabia was a pariah state and he would have no time and no truck and would spare no effort in putting Saudi Arabia out into the wilderness as a pariah on the world stage. And now, because of the fuel crisis, he's gone back to Saudi Arabia, he's gone back to the Gulf countries, he's begged them to increase production. So it's a double-edged sword, and it's a win-win for America and the EU. They get to sell their armaments at vast profits for their military-industrial complex, and at the same time, those weapons are used in a proxy war. So Americans aren't dying, Europeans aren't dying, it's Yemenis who are dying in this fight between basically the US and what it sees as Iranian interests within the region. So the US is a win-win. It gets all this money from Saudi Arabia, it sells them all the arms and all the weapons, and it allows those weapons to be used in its name to kill civilians in Yemen, which is a war crime, and there's absolutely no comeback against the American administration. And someone said recently America is involved in 76 different conflicts across the globe. I find that hard to believe, but if it is true, then that's just, it's immoral, it's unacceptable, and it's time American hegemony finished.
The date was September, the month that is, September 2022, not that far or a long time ago, Farahis. And that was when it was the anniversary of Yemen's September 26th, what they called Revolution Day. And it was an awesome display that they showed in terms of their military might through various equipments. You mentioned drones. They put that on display, ballistic missiles, and a huge variety of different types of military equipment. I'm sure the Saudis took notice, never mind the millions that attended. That's one thing that always surprises many when it comes to these rallies different demonstrations. So many people show up in support of the Yemeni government. Anyways, if I'm Saudi Arabia looking at that, I would take note of that. Are we looking now that this truce seems to have ended, that we are entering or re-entering the war phase again? There have been reports of sporadic clashes in the past day.
I suppose to re-enter the war phase, if we're going to use that terminology, it takes one side to actually carry out a sustained military campaign with either rockets or artillery fire, mortars or planes. So until it reaches that level, sporadic fighting could just be regional kind of spats between the two separate combatants. But I think what we're looking at here is, like, from what I can see as an outsider, I'm definitely not someone who's fully conversed with what's happening in Yemen. But what I can see is that Saudi Arabia can destroy the infrastructure and murder countless hundreds of thousands of civilians, but they cannot win the war on the ground. I mean, that has been obvious since 2015. Now, the Ansar Allah movement does not really have an air force as such. It's all ground forces. It's brave revolutionaries and a people-led militia and former segments of the Yemeni army that is helping to fight and defend the Yemen kind of countryside and the constitution. So Yemen can't win the war on the ground. Saudi Arabia can't win the war on the ground. So you're just talking about a prolonged, unnecessary conflict where neither side, short of total victory from either side, is going to win. So either a national reconciliation government that has components of the whole country, which is left alone without interference from Saudi Arabia and the West, is allowed to come into being. I don't see there being any peace. But I do believe, as I've said, that the drone technology, it will level the battlefield entirely. And once or if there are attacks on the Saudi oil infrastructure and all of a sudden the production drops to 100,000 barrels a day, I think America will go in straight away and say, we need to end this conflict now because it is now affecting American strategic national interests, which is the flow of oil from the Middle East to West Asia, or from West Asia to the European Union.
Well, you have two factors there, and my final question to you. One is the Bab el-Mandab Strait. The other is the fact that they have issued a warning. The Ansar Allah movement has actually issued a warning, telling the oil companies in UAE and also in Saudi Arabia to basically to watch out because they could be targeted. Are we looking at those two areas actually being targets or something to break out there?
Well, I think in the short term, the Ansar Allah movement will just sit back and see exactly what the reaction is. I mean, if they're not going to prolong the truce, it doesn't mean they're automatically going back to war. They're just saying they are no longer involved in the peace process and the ceasefire, and that without the total lifting of the siege, that hostilities may resume. I would imagine that the Ansar Allah movement will sit back and wait and see what the response is from the Saudis and the Americans and take their lead from that. The Ansar Allah movement is not a terrorist organization. It's not deliberately targeting civilians. It's not on a war footing okay. Where it goes, we're not getting what we want, we're going back to war. So I think time will tell in the next 10 days.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much, and thank you for sticking with us throughout this, Frahiz. We appreciate it. Frahiz from Belfast, political activist, and for the little time we had, Hossein Boukhaiti from Sana'a, we do appreciate it, activist and political commentator. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks so much for tuning in. It's goodbye from me and the team from the capital, Tehran. Until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, we have started explanation of Surah Mujadala, or the Pleader, which is number 58 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It was revealed in Medina and mentioned the complaint of a woman whose husband had put her away by resorting to the pagan Arab formula known as Zahar, which consists of the words, "You are to me as the back of my mother." This was a pagan custom to imply a kind of divorce that freed the husband from any responsibility for conjugal duties, as well as providing support for children, but without allowing the wife the freedom to leave the husband's home or to contract a second marriage. The woman, who along with her husband had become a Muslim, pleaded to the Prophet against this unjust behavior and said she also lacked the means to support her little children. Her prayer to Allah and her plea was accepted, and this brutal and unjust custom of the pagan Arabs was abolished through the revelation of this surah, which goes on to state that those who oppose God and the Prophet or fall to the temptations of the Satan or lie in their oaths and make intrigues against the Prophet will be defeated and suffer humiliation both in this world and in the hereafter, while Hezbollah, or the party of Allah, which means those who have firm faith in God, will triumph. We start from where we left you a fortnight ago in our last episode of this series, and here are ayahs 12 and 13 of the said surah.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا إذا ناجيتم الرسول فقدموا بين يدي نجواكم صدقة ذلك خير لكم وأطهر فإن لم تجدوا فإن الله غفور رحيم أأشفقتم أن تقدموا بين يدي نجواكم صدقات فإذ لم تفعلوا وتاب الله عليكم فأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة وأطيعوا الله ورسوله والله خبير بما تعملون
Oh, you who have faith, when you talk secretly to the Prophet, offer a charity before your secret talk. That is better for you and purer. But if you cannot afford, then Allah is indeed all-forgiving, all-merciful. Were you apprehensive of offspring charities before your secret talks? So, as you did not do it, and Allah was merciful to you, maintain the prayer and pay the zakat and obey Allah and His Prophet. And Allah is well aware of what you do. If you might recall, in our last episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, while explaining the previous ayahs of this surah, we had said that secret talks and seemingly private councils at public gatherings are forbidden except to provide security and safeguard one's honor or to prevent the disclosure of some important and sensitive matters. Advice and admonishment, however, ought to be done without publicity in order to have the desired effect. The ayahs that we recited to you now refer to the habit of some affluent persons who, in the presence of several others, used to come near to the Prophet and try to whisper to him as if they were holding a private council, much to the embarrassment of the Prophet and that of others, especially the poor Muslims. Their aim was to seek privileges in vain, and besides, they wasted the precious time of the Prophet. Therefore, God Almighty revealed these ayahs as a trial for them to spend from their wealth as a source of charitable offerings for the poor and as an efficient means for lessening such troubles. Moreover, expending in the cause of Allah purifies the hearts of the affluent from craving worldly privileges and those of the needy from hatred and grief. This was an effective way in ending disturbances and undue request. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, Islam has dealt in various ways to remove poverty from society and recommended charity at every opportunity. Number two, charity has two aspects: to do righteous deeds in the form of helping others, and to purify the spirit of the rich from stinginess. And number three, Islamic laws are in accordance with the financial and physical abilities of every individual. Now let us listen to ayahs 14 and 15 of the same surah.
أَلَمْ تَرَ إِلَى الَّذِينَ تَوَلَّوْا قَوْمًا غَضِبَ اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِمْ مَا هُمْ مِنْكُمْ وَلَا مِنْهُمْ وَيَحْلِفُونَ عَلَى الْكَذِبِ وَهُمْ يَعْلَمُونَ أعد الله لهم عذابا شديدا إنهم ساء ما كانوا يعملون.
Have you not regarded those who befriend the people at whom Allah is wrathful? They neither belong to you nor to them, and they swear false oaths while they know. Allah has prepared a severe punishment for them. Evil indeed is what they used to do. These ayahs refer to the secret ties of the hypocrites amongst Muslims with the enemies of Islam. These are a disclosure of the conspiracies of the hypocrites who should not be trusted and against whose designs extra cautiousness is required, even if they take oaths, since their pledges are false. It also means that the attempts by some to hold private councils with the Prophet at public gatherings was hypocrisy and a stratagem to try to get information for passing on to the enemies of Islam. The hypocrites are opportunists and are friends of no one. Thus, the All-Merciful Lord has warned the doers of such evil acts with a severe punishment. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, hypocrites always try to exploit the situation and pretend to be friends. Thus, it is necessary to recognize them
and prevent them from deceiving the simple-minded people. And number two, political and economic relations with non-Muslims should not lead to acceptance of their dominance. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, here are ayahs 16 and 17 of Surah Mujadala.
اتخذوا أيمانهم جنة فصدوا عن سبيل الله فلهم عذاب مهين لن تغني عنهم أموالهم ولا أولادهم من الله شيئا أولئك أصحاب النار هم فيها خالدون
They make a shield of their oaths and bar people from the way of Allah. So there is a humiliating punishment for them. Their possessions and children will never avail them in any way against Allah. They shall be the inmates of the fire, and they shall remain in it forever. Hypocrites try to appear in religious garb amongst the believers. They speak of religion and God in a way such as resorting to false oaths, in order to mislead some simple-minded people and prevent them from discovering the truth and realities of Islam. The hypocrites are warned of a humiliating punishment from which there is no escape for them, either through their worldly possessions or their children, because of their lack of faith and plots against the true believers. Such persons shall be cast into hell and remain there forever in torment. These ayahs teach us that number one, the stratagem of the hypocrites is to undermine Islam by claiming to be Muslim in order to prevent the proper promotion in society of God's commandments. Number two, it is nothing but foolishness on the part of the hypocrites to think of themselves to be clever, when their end is humiliation, both in the transient life of this world and in the hereafter. And number three, wealth, power, and children may be of help in the world, but will be of no avail in the hereafter.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.